You're listening to The Jewish Truth Bomb with Lenny Goldberg.
Hey, this is Lenny Goldberg, and thank you for joining me today. Hope you all had a great Purim. Every so often, people come up to me on Purim, a little bit drunk. And, you know, usually people who don't talk to you during the year. That's part of the fun of Purim. You lose your inhibitions and you speak to people you might not have spoken to during the year. That's part of the thing of Mashloach Manot. You give to people that you don't usually have contact with. And then it's like a nice feeling because you're talking to people, to neighbors who you don't always speak to. That's part of the beauty of Purim. Mishloach Manot Ish L'Re'ehu, sending good vibes to one another. So anyway, people are a little bit tipsy, less inhibitions, and somebody will come up to me and say, this is your holiday. This is the holiday of the Kahanists. So I guess what they mean is that because Purim, we're basically celebrating revenge over our enemies, and because the Kahana people talk a lot about vengeance, that makes it our holiday. Now, it's really a kind of silly thing to say, because you could take Hanukkah. I mean, what's that about? What do we say? Nekamta nikmatam. You wrought vengeance on our enemies. So there too, you had the Maccabees avenging Jewish honor against the Greeks. I mean, think about it. Passover celebrates lots of vengeance on the Egyptians. You even have a special holiday, the seventh day of Passover, a special yontiv, which celebrates what? The drowning of the Egyptians. Imagine that, a special yontiv just for vengeance against the Egyptians. That's it. They drowned. Let's have a party. So it's not a kach thing. It's a Jewish thing. Because a considerable portion of Judaism, whether we want to admit it or not, centers around vengeance, killing the bad guy, rejoicing over the fall of our enemy. What can you do? And I still hear rabbis from their pulpits somehow apologizing for this, not understanding it, as if we're killing the bad guy b'dievid. It's not something we want to do, but we're forced into it. No, lichatchila we want to do it. Even if you look at the Psalms, I mean, half of it is about King David asking Hashem to punish the wicked. And it's not that we love vengeance because we love the blood and the guts, but it's because, as the sages say, as long as the wicked rule in the world, ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu yoshev al kiso, the Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't sit on his throne. That's why we seek vengeance. That's why King David writes in Psalms 58, Yismach Sadiq Chazanakam, happy is the man who saw vengeance. Palmav yachatz b'damav rasha, he washed his palms in the blood of the wicked. So that sounds pretty gross, right? Today anyway, it's not mikubal. But why does the tzaddik want the vengeance? Well, King David explains it in the very next verse. He says like this, V'yomar Adam, and then mankind will say, that is after he sees the vengeance, Yomar Adam, man will say, Ach, pri l'tzaddik. Indeed, there is a reward for the righteous. Ach, yesh Elokim shoftim ba'aretz. Indeed, there is a God who judges the land. You see why we want vengeance and why King David wanted vengeance? The key to the grand concept of vengeance is what I just said. Because without it, it makes the bad guys look like they won. Ve'ein Elokim shoftim ba'aretz. Ve'ein pri l'tzaddik. It's like there's no Hashem in the world. Ein din. Ein dayan. There's no judge. The world is chaos. The world is hefker. There's a chilul Hashem. The bad guys do whatever they want. They wreak havoc on the world. They're wicked. And there's no repercussions. That's what happens when there's no vengeance. People say, ein din, ein dayan. There's no Hashem. If there was Hashem, he wouldn't let this happen. That's why chilul Hashem comes from the word halal, empty. It's like the world is empty of God. But only when there's vengeance. Ah, yesh Elokim shoftim ba'aretz. Then we know there's a God that judges the world. And that's why a large part of Judaism revolves around this concept. And a major part of the Bible centers around it too. So how did we get to this point where Judaism turned into Christianity? Where you got to turn the other cheek? You got to be better than they are? Not to sink to their level? You got to sink 6 feet below their level? How do we get here? Well, obviously, it's the exile that emasculated the Torah and all these grand concepts, which are basically nationalistic concepts. Because on a personal level, you're forbidden to take vengeance. That's what it means in the verse, Al tikom al titor. You're not allowed to take vengeance. It's a verse in the Torah. But that's talking about a personal level, on your neighbor. You have bad relations with your neighbor. You don't wish upon him bad things. But on a national level, it's a mitzvah. Now, in the Gullus, there was no national level. There was no national entity. So for 2,000 years, we're learning about how vengeance is wrong. It's wrong. Al tikom, al titor. Do not seek vengeance. But again, that's against your fellow neighbor who you don't get along with on a personal level. And people somehow can't distinguish this. They say, oh, you're not allowed to take vengeance. Al tikom, al titor. It's a verse in the Torah. Even Haman, the Purim villain, made the same mistake. Yeah, he made the same mistake that Jews often make, thinking that we should not seek vengeance or be happy at the fall of our enemy. That's what Haman thought. It says this in Masechet Megillah, page 16. When Haman came to lead Mordechai on the king's horse, remember when Ahasuerus had that dream and everything now turned around to the Jews' favor. So now Haman has to lead Mordechai on the king's horse. So what does it say in Masechet Megillah? Haman said to Mordechai, get up and ride. See, Mordechai was expecting he's going to get killed now by Haman. He didn't know that the decree was mitapech, that it was turned over and the king now wants to celebrate Mordechai. He doesn't know that, but he realizes it now when Haman says to him, get up on the horse and ride. So Mordechai said, listen, I've been fasting. Tanit Esther, right? I'm fasting. I'm weak. So what did Haman do? He bent down in order to allow Mordechai to climb on him. And when he bent down, Mordechai kicked him. And Haman said to him, but does it not say in your books that when your enemy falls, don't rejoice? So Haman, who probably knows more Judaism than most Jewish leaders, he quotes Proverbs 24, verse 17, where it says, Haman says to Mordechai, it says in your books, you shouldn't gloat when you're winning. Mordechai said to him, that's concerning a Jewish enemy. But with you, it's written, Albamotechem tidrochu, you shall trample on their high places. A verse in Deuteronomy chapter 33. So for Jews who think that you're not supposed to rejoice over your enemy and you're not supposed to take vengeance on your enemy, you're basically like Haman HaRasha, the wicked Haman. We're happy because it's only through vengeance that God is vindicated. Because the same enemy who crowed when success smiled upon him, he said, there's no God in Israel. His fall proves that there is a God in Israel. But the Hellenist modern-dox type, well, that's a problem for him. And at the Purim feast, as we rejoice in the vengeance against Haman, let us drink a toast to the demise too of this gentilized nonsense and the distortion of the great Jewish concept of vengeance. Now, we all know the custom that when Haman is mentioned in the Megillah reading, everybody makes noise. Kids are shooting off their cap guns. They got firecrackers blasting, the groggers, making a lot of noise. So what's the origin of that custom? Well, when the Jews were in the exile, they didn't have real guns or weapons to kill the enemy. So we made use of toy guns and make-believe battle noises because that's the only thing we had. It's the closest thing to us fighting back. But today, hey, we have real guns. We have the most advanced weaponry in the world. We don't have to pretend anymore. We don't have to fake it. But it's not just that. Not only do we have real weapons, we don't have to fake it. We have a real Amalek. The Arab, he is your classic Amalekian. His whole existence is to kill Jews. That's Amalek. It's an entire nation that thinks that way. You know, more Gazans voted for the Hamas than the Germans voted for Hitler. If there was ever a nation that filled the shoes of Amalek, it's them. Where every man, woman, and child is poised to kill a Jew at any time. And so, yeah, we have real weapons and we have real Amalekites. What we're missing is the courage of one Mordechai. Yeah, just one Mordechai. Now, what makes Mordechai so great? He's the hero of Purim. So what epitomizes him is when it says, Lo korea velo mishtachaveh. He does not kneel or bow. He does not prostrate himself. That's Mordechai. Lo mishtachaveh. And Rabbi Yitzchak Shapira, who's one of the rabbis of the Yeshiva Od Yosef Chai, he asks, what does it mean, lo kara velo mishtachaveh? He doesn't kneel and he doesn't prostrate himself. It's obvious that if he's not kneeling, he's not going to prostrate himself. If you prostrate yourself, that's going all the way down on the ground. So for sure he doesn't kneel. So it's kind of superfluous to say, lo kara velo mishtachaveh. So what the rabbi says is, we're not just talking about the physical bowing down. We're talking about bowing down to the norms of society. That is, while everybody, including the rabbis and the sages of his generation, they were accepting the norms. You got to lay low. You got to make good with the empire. Mordechai did not succumb to them. You see, it's not just a matter of knowing Torah, of knowing the Shulchan Aruch back and forth. We're talking about emunah, bitachon, to go against the grain. That's something that transcends somebody's knowledge of halacha. That's what makes him Mordechai HaYehudi. And it's interesting that he's referred to as Mordechai HaYehudi. What about Yehudi? After all, when you say Yehudi, that's supposed to be the Jews from the tribe of Yehuda. Mordechai is from the tribe of Binyamin. So why is he Mordechai HaYehudi? Because he represents the essence of what a Jew is. A Jew doesn't bow down, not to Avodah Zarah, not to Haman, and not to Washington. And that's who Mordechai was, a proud Jew who didn't back down. You look at the Jews in high position in Shushan, like Mordechai and Esther. Compare them to the Jews in high position, to the court Jews in Washington, like Chuck Schumer and Anthony Blinken. Look what they do in their high position. What did Mordechai say to Esther to motivate her? He said, who knows, maybe Shem puts you in your position to help your people. And Esther was willing to do it. She put herself on the line for her people. She says, okay, v'mibadati. And if I die, I die. I'll do my best. And eventually she tells Achashverosh, how can I sit quietly while my people are about to be slaughtered? Now compare that to Blinken and Schumer, Jews who have taken the side of the enemy against their own people. As Israel is fighting for its very survival, its boys are dying, its boys are bleeding, and these Jewish traitors use their high position to put the screws to Israel. I want to talk now about Megillat Esther itself. You know, the Tanakh, and I give a Bible class, you can listen to my Bible classes, Lenny Goldberg's Bible classes. We're trying to cover the whole Tanakh. We're in the book of Shmuel right now. But the Bible, the Tanakh, it's not the history of the Jewish people. That's for history books. I mean, if you wanted a history of the Jewish people, that's not a book. That would fill a library. There would be a lot of books on the history of the Jewish people. So the Tanakh isn't history, because then it would be something of the past. We're learning about the past. But no, the Tanakh is everything. It symbolizes something now. It teaches something eternal, lessons forever. And the Megillat Esther is no different. It's not just a story. The Megillat Esther is a prototype of what the Gullus is. That's why it's written in the Tanakh. It's to teach us a microcosm of what's Gullus. It's teaching us the phenomenon of the exile, where the Jew is basically just trying to survive. That's what the exile is. He can't really thrive. He can only just survive. Because Megillat Esther, when you think about it, it's really a horror movie. It's a horror film. The Jews are thriving in Persia. They're invited to the Suda. They've made it big time. They're accepted. And then in an instant, their world is turned upside down. That's the exile. You think it's going good until it's not. That's the story of the American Jew who, in his neurotic need to self-delude himself, because for centuries he's been persecuted. So he's got to believe that finally he's found that haven. And so he creates for himself these self-deluding myths that this exile, it's going to be okay. And so Jews are always trying to prove that their castle in America is safe. What do? They look at the social progress of the Jew and all these other statistics. And every appointment of some Jew to some position or to some high office, that's turned into a proof that the Jew has reached the promised land. But as we see in Megillat Esther and in America today, it's a very fragile myth, because the sad truth is that most of the American Jews, they never really believed in their own self-deception. How do you know? Because whenever some lunatic or shooter shoots up a school, the whole Jewish community is hoping, I hope it's not a Jew. I remember back in the 70s, there was the Son of Sam murderer, and he was a serial killer. And for a couple of weeks, he was making headlines. He was killing people. And nobody knew who he was. He was leaving notes. And the whole city was just like focused on this. It was like the New York Post headline every day. And when they finally caught him, his name was David Berkowitz. And the whole Jewish community was sweating, because that's a Jewish name. And in the end, he wasn't Jewish. Oh, there was a communal sigh of relief from all the Jews. Thank God, Son of Sam, that nut, David Berkowitz, isn't really Jewish. Baruch Hashem. But that's the exile. You never really are on solid ground. And it doesn't take much to rock your fragile world. Now, there's another component of galut in the story of Purim, and that's how Mordechai is forced to conduct himself. As heroic as he is, he's helpless too. I mean, he's just trying to survive out there. He's just riding the wave. What does he do to save the Jews? He has to do what they call shadlanut. He's lobbying. He got to lobby the Malchut all the time. He has to send in Esther to get together with Achashverosh in order to save the Jews. I mean, that's not the ideal situation. You're going to send your wife, according to many opinions, Esther was his wife, to this uncircumcised Persian. But that's what you got to do to survive in the galut. Because that's what the galut is. You can't really fight back. And even when you have the salvation, it's only temporary. I mean, the Jews in Persia were saved, for this time anyway, but who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? Think about it. When the smoke clears in that Purim story, yeah, the Jews were saved, but look what happened. Esther's married to Achashverosh? Wow, what Yiddish and Nachas I'm getting from this. And by the way, that's why we don't say Hallel on Purim. We say it on Hanukkah. Why? Because holiday of Purim took place in the exile, and redemption in the exile is very limited. The best you can do is not get wiped out. Baruch Hashem, we didn't get wiped out. The Hanukkah miracle took place in Israel. You didn't just get saved, but you beat on the enemy. And we restored Jewish sovereignty to the land of Israel. That's a different level. And on Hanukkah, we say Hallel. So you can ask, why do we celebrate Purim in the first place? Isn't it your typical Hasidic story you see in the storybooks where the big bad goy, or the king, or the pecha, he lays down some decree against the Jews. And the Jews, they send in the tzaddik to lobby, and they pray and they fast. And Baruch Hashem, it's a miracle, the Jews are saved. Isn't that what Purim is? So what's the big deal? Why is it turned into a holiday? I'll tell you why. Because on Purim, we weren't just saved from the decree of destruction, but we killed them. We went on offense. Now that is not your typical galut story miracle. If we hadn't taken vengeance on our enemies in Shushan, this would have just been another classic galut tale where the Jews were safe from the evil decree. But Purim is special because we did to them what they wanted to do to us. But getting back to our point about life in the exile, no matter how good it may seem, it's a delusion. That's what happened in Shushan, and it's happening in America too. And I want to give a parallel here, because in both situations, in Persia back then and today in America, because in both stories, you see how the Jew haters are able to rile up the people against the Jews. How do they do it? They do it by changing the narrative, okay? It's a fight for the narrative. In America, the narrative has become that the Israelis are these white European colonialists who took Israel away from the poor indigenous Arabs. That's what they're saying, and that's how they basically justify October 7th. Because after all, the Jews stole the land for the Arabs. And so everything the Arabs do is justified. So all the Jew haters have to do is spin history, lie, and since nobody knows history anyway, the words of these Jew haters fall on willing ears. Okay, now, if you look at the Midrashim, what Haman did the same thing. He simply changed the narrative. Because think about it. How was he able to convince all of the Persians to wipe out the Jews just like that? And that's what was going to happen if things weren't turned around and we didn't get a miracle. So if you look at the Megillat Esther at the end of chapter 3, you see that Haman issues his decree of genocide. He writes these letters to the governors of every province, to all the officials. And in Midrash Esther Rabbah, we see what Haman wrote to convince the Persians to lashmid larog v'la'abed, to destroy, slay, and exterminate all the Jews, from young to old, children and women, in one day. What did he write in these documents that he sent out to every province? So if you look at the Midrash Esther Rabbah, it explains what Haman wrote in those letters to incite everybody against the Jews. And I'm going to read a little bit of it because it's very interesting. In Esther Rabbah, chapter 7, Haman wrote like this. Look at these Jews amongst us. They are an ungrateful people. Look what happened in Egypt. They went to Egypt. They were received with great hospitality. They were settled in the finest part of Egypt. They were provided for in the famine years. Yet, they rebelled. And they tricked Paro. They said they were leaving for 3 days, but they lied. And they said to the Egyptians, lend us your silver and gold vessels and your garments. And after stripping Egypt clean, they loaded up their donkeys. They went on their way. And when Pharaoh heard that they were fleeing, he followed them to recover his property. Anyway, you get the idea. Haman is inciting them by telling partial truths, putting a spin on it, leaving out some important facts like the slavery, like Joseph. But a lot of what he said is factual. And after all, the Purim story took place between the first and second temple period, and the Exodus from Egypt was way before that. Nobody remembers it that much anyway. Just like a lot of Americans, what do they really know about history? You could just spin it the way you want it. I just want to read a little bit more of this, how Haman twists the truth. I'm reading from Esther Rabbah, chapter 7, as Haman continues in his letters of incitement. He writes like this. And then my grandfather, Amalek, came along to wage war against them. Why do they do this? Why did my grandfather Amalek go to war against the Jews? Well, they took counsel with Bilam. Amalek said to Bilam, look what this nation did to Egypt, the same country that had been hospitable to them and was kind to them. And that was to a nation that was good to them, all the more so they're going to do to other nations. So Bilam advised Amalek to go out to war against the Jews. And you can win it, Bilam said, because the Jews have the merit of Abraham, their forefather, and so do you. You are a descendant of Abraham as well. You come from Esau, right? Amalek is the descendant of Esau. So you can also rely on the merit of Abraham. And so what happened? As we know, Amalek went to war with Israel. Moses had a disciple named Joshua ben Nun, who was extremely cruel and had no mercy. Anyway, this letter of Haman goes on and on, twisting history to his favor. And that's how he was able to turn everyone against the Jews overnight. And that's what they do today. They stress out cruelty in Gaza. Just like Joshua, he was very cruel. So is the IDF. They're very cruel. They have no mercy. So you see how easy it is to turn things around and how unstable the Gullus is? Last week, Jonathan Pollard was speaking in Mitzpah Yericho to the settlers there. And this is what he had to say about American Jewry.
The needle has turned. I mean, it's past the median point right now. Look, every diaspora experience that we've had over 2,000 years has always ended the same way, and it wasn't a good way. And this is happening now because anti-Semitism has been mainstreamed. It's acceptable now to be a Jew hater. Why would you want to stay in an environment like that when now, for the first time in 2,000 years, we have a viable alternative called Israel? This is why when I got off the airplane here at Ben Gurion, the main thing I tried to say was that Israel is the future of the Jewish people. And boy, did I get slammed back in New York for that. The bottom line is, what will wake them up? At this point, you could have a Kristallnacht in the United States, and it still wouldn't wake them up. They just are totally addicted to this myth that the United States is somehow different from all other countries that we've ended up in over the past 2,000 years.
Okay, that's my Purim spiel for today. Don't forget to order the Haggadah of the Jewish Idea, Binyamin Kahana's amazing commentary. It's getting a little bit late. We got about a month before Passover. The mail is horrible. I hope the people who ordered books got their books. If you did get your book, let me know. I want to make sure you got it. And, you know, you can pay me if you want to. So to order your Haggadah, it's LennyGoldberg40@gmail.com. Lenny Goldberg, the number 40. Lenny has two N's in it. Lenny Goldberg, the number 40, @gmail.com. Give me your address, and I'll get it to you. See you next week.